This is the Mind Body Work podcast dedicated to discussions about the well-being and health of working professionals. My first guest speaker today is Dr. Uta Liash, who is a HCPC accredited practitioner, psychologist, and a BPS chartered counselling psychologist, specialising in anxiety, ADHD, burnout, grief, trauma, and complex psychopathology. An expert in treating victims of narcissism, she also provides high performance and executive coaching. Her personal background includes roles at the Hospice of St. Francis, the Priory, NHS, and as an associate lecturer at Birkbeck University of London. Uta is skilled in EMDR, ACT, exposure therapy, autogenetic training, and mindfulness-based psychotherapy. Hello, Uta. Thank you so much for joining me this afternoon. How are you?
I'm very well, and thank you so much for having me. It's an honor and a pleasure to be here.
Oh, wonderful. Well, we're so excited to have you here today on our mental health podcast. Today's podcast is called Healthy Minds, Productive Workplaces, What You Need to Know. And in this session, we'll take a hard look at five specific mental health issues, which are anxiety, depression, PTSD, OCD, and eating disorders. Yeah. So first on our list is a topic that touches millions, yet often remains shrouded in silence, and that is anxiety. It's a condition that doesn't discriminate, affecting individuals across age groups, professions, and backgrounds. So to start us off, Uta, could you share some insights on the demographics most affected by anxiety disorders in the UK? And what are some common causes? And how does anxiety typically influence daily living and personal relationships?
Of course. And I think what is most important to know right at the beginning is that younger people are much more likely to have a form of anxiety. And it decreases, interestingly, through the age group. And those people who are around 70 year old are the least likely group of people who have an anxiety disorder or actually experiencing any type of anxiety. If we look at gender differences, women report more anxiety levels than men do. But I think, you know, there is a really important message here in the sentence I've just used. It's the reporting. Because what we do also think is that men are a lot less likely to talk about that they feel anxious, worried, or have actually fear, because it might just not link in very well with the role they have to play or think they have to play in our society.
Very interesting. And do you think that younger people are probably experiencing this heightened anxiety due to social media? Those kind of trends?
I think social media does play a part of it. There are kind of two, we can categorize two types of anxiety broadly. One is a very concrete anxiety and one is quite a hypothetical anxiety. Now, concrete anxiety is, if you have to write an exam, you're frightened, right? And any person would be, of course, anxious because you want to do well. So that's an anxiety that has a very concrete reason, and we can manage that and we can work with it, and this makes sense, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Then there is something which we call hypothetical anxiety, and that hypothetical anxiety is when your mind goes absolutely down, I think the best way is to call it a rabbit hole. There are a couple of words which our mind uses in order to stir up hypothetical anxiety. And it's this very well-known yes, but, or the what if. Now, when you go into the social media world, there is, of course, always another level, right? Another level of seeing, of success, or pretended success, let's say it like this, or even more perfect beauty, or even greater likes. Whether this is actually reality or whether it's fake, we don't know. But it takes us away from concreteness and puts us very quickly into the world of hypothetical. And that is the anxiety, which has a really, really negative effect on our mental health and our mental well-being.
Absolutely. And what impact does that have on personal relationships, would you say?
It has a huge impact because think about what anxiety actually is. Anxiety is nothing else than the information that there is danger around us. Now, what do humans do normally And rightly so, when there is danger, we hide, right? We withdraw, we go away. And the effect it has on relationships is that we are actually withdrawing from relationships. And worst case scenario is that people we are working with, they sit in the room, they are so scared to go out. They don't even go out any longer. And if they then come to the clinic, you know, if they open the door to the soak, that's already the first step into combating such negative anxiety, because they are re-engaging with the world. And that's a big task.
Obviously, it's incredibly detrimental and something that employers and organisations absolutely need to think about. So let's turn our focus to the second critical issue that significantly impacts our mental health, and that's depression, which is much more than just feeling sad or going through a rough patch. It's a persistent problem that affects millions of people from all walks of life. So could you just help us understand depression a little bit more by shedding some light on the recent statistics regarding prevalence of depression across different age groups in the UK, and possibly some triggers and how it can impact us?
Can I just say thank you for the first sentence you said? It is not the same as sadness. Commonly, especially, let me go back to the first idea around social media. In social media, these terms are used interchangeably, which is absolutely wrong, because it is a persistent mood that really destroys the way you are engaging with the world and with yourself. Mm-hmm. We believe it's about 5% of adults who suffer from depression across the world. Again, apparently more women than men, but again, I'm asking for caution here, because we can only talk about numbers that are reported. And it is still the case that men do not talk about their more difficult emotions as openly as women do, although it is changing, which I'm very, very happy about, of course. It's the most common mental illness. 1 in 6 people in the UK are affected by it across all age groups, including children.
And any potential triggers that on a day-to-day basis which might spark it up at all?
Yeah, I mean, there is something in our clinical understanding which we called kind of a very quick onset depression. But commonly, depression is something that needs to build up over time. And I would like to bring in a theory by Seligman, which is called the learned helplessness theory. And this is the idea: is if we are learning that we cannot change our surrounding, that it will be stable, negatively stable, across time and across space, and everything that goes wrong is actually always consistently due to us, what we learn is that we are helpless in changing the world, and that the world will be as depressing as we're experiencing it today. Now, what you can imagine, of course, if this is something you believe strongly, that this never changes, life becomes very, very, very dark very, very quickly. And this, over time, is a precursor of what we are then calling in our clinic, and what we are, of course, treating in the soap, about depression.
Mm. Oh, that's really interesting. Thank you. And just moving on to the next one now, which is a condition often born from, unfortunately, severe trauma, and that's post-traumatic stress disorder, or commonly known PTSD. So, as I say, can emerge from distressing experiences and unfortunately cast long-term shadows over one's life.
Yeah.
Who are the people most likely to develop PTSD in the UK?
Yeah.
And what are some common triggers, and how does it influence a person's social interactions and their ability to engage in social daily activities?
So commonly, imagine PTSD being something where you have an experience, a traumatic experience, that is not transformed in the brain and put into the long-term memory so that you can remember it, but it's not active any longer. I like to call it's an open memory that still influences you on a daily basis, which means that traumatic experience is with you 24/7. You see the world through it. It is actually not as rare as we believe. It's about 4 to 6% of the UK population.
Oh.
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
And we know it's you know, 1 in 5 firefighters have it, police officers, 1 in 3 teenagers who survive accidents like a car crash, for example. 1 in 2 rape survivors have PTSD, and 1 in 3 prisoners of war. I mean, what you can imagine with the groups I have just said, there are some groups out there which are probably more vulnerable. Of course, our army forces are on the top of that list. But as you heard, you know, car crash, rape, all of these things, of course, can unfortunately happen to each one of us.
Yeah, I was really surprised to hear that statistic there, as I didn't realise that it was that prevalent as it is.
Yeah.
You hear PTSD, but it's such a shocking kind of thing to go through. You wouldn't think it'd be around as much as it is. So that really shows that there will be people who suffer with this kind of thing in the UK workforce all the time.
Absolutely. So the traditional symptoms are, for example, flashbacks, which means we have a trigger. And, you know, it can be a smell which pulls us back to that moment in which we had to experience, in which we were a victim of that traumatic event. Can be nightmares. It will always come with severe anxiety, of course. Thoughts crush your mind, I would say. You know, they befall your thinking, and you cannot do anything about it and against it. And what is not very often mentioned, but what we see in our clinic all the time, is that it changes the personality of the person and their understanding of who they are, which is not very much spoken of. But of course, if you cannot control any longer how you perceive the world, because a flashback can be incredibly vivid, you of course start doubting whether you know who you are, if that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. Oh, that's really insightful. I think that's really beneficial to understand properly what kind of going through somebody's mind when they are experiencing these really negative and difficult feelings.
Mm-hmm.
And I just want to move forward to a condition that is often misunderstood and misrepresented, I feel, and that's obsessive compulsive disorder, commonly known as OCD.
Yeah.
There are a lot of stereotypes out there and occasional jokes, but OCD is actually a really challenging reality for many people.
Yeah.
And it's marked by reoccurring unwanted thoughts and irrational excessive urges to do certain actions. But are you able to just tell us a bit more about the true nature of OCD and the demographics most commonly affected?
Yes.
How it impacts behaviours and the ability to manage our day-to-day tasks?
Yeah. So 25 of the cases starting at the age of 14, which is very young, of course.
Yes.
And 1 in 100 people are affected by OCD over a lifetime. So again, we are talking quite a wide number. And you are right. There are these jokes when somebody is, you know, very, very tidy or particular about where stuff has to be. You hear that a bit OCD very quickly being, you know, thrown into.
Yeah, all the time you hear that.
Yeah, yeah. And if you are a tidy person like I am, you know, you're being told that a lot. And whilst, you know, we shouldn't take everything too seriously, because that's not good for our mental health either. We need to also make sure that we use the right words for the right behavior. Because OCD, when we see people with an OCD diagnosis in the SOC, it is really debilitating. So what I mean with that, you need to have a particular fear of something. And that fear is so deeply rooted, so essential, that you are having this idea that this fear could take your life. If that's what I fear happens, which is very unlikely, but that's not what your mind allows you to think, it is life endangering. And in order to manage that fear, I have to do a particular behavior to actually function in any shape or form. So that means if you have a fear of germ, for example, you will not be able to stop washing your hands, because the moment you stop washing your hands, that fear of these germs that will kill you, and I'm talking in absolutes now, because that's what my patients have told me, they will kill me. I will not survive the day. And this is the power of such thoughts. That's the power of such fear you can see in patients, in clients, in people we work with OCD.
And once you have that train of thought in your mind, it's so difficult to train it differently, train it otherwise, to kind of let go of these absolutes, as you call them. Very, very tough.
Yes.
And it really highlights how you shouldn't use a bit OCD so lightheartedly, because people really do struggle with that on a daily basis, as you said.
Yes. And the English language has so many words. Let's just be a bit more creative than rather using the wrong word for the wrong behavior.
Yeah, I agree. I couldn't agree more. So let's just turn our attention to the last one on our list, and that is eating disorders. And they do encompass a range of psychological challenges. Could be severely disruptive to our eating behaviours, physical health, and social interactions. So just for the last one there, Uta, could you help us better understand this issue?
Absolutely.
Thank you.
1.2 to 3.4 million people in the UK are affected by it. Let me say the number again. 1.2 to 3.4 million people are affected by a type of eating disorder. That's a huge amount of people.
Huge amount.
We call it also often in clinic the silent killer, because if you have gone into starvation mode for long enough, there is no way back. We see women who starve themselves so much that they can't have, they don't have a period any longer. Even if they recover, their ability to fall pregnant might be destroyed forever. It is gruesome to see. It is absolutely gruesome to see. And I think it is a disorder which is still glorified because it makes people slim. And when we look when we walk through London and we look at all the advertisement, men and women, of course, we like the slim bodies, right? So 25% of those ones who have eating disorders are men. So the boys are really catching up here. And this is not a statistic that I have, but would you allow me to say something out of my clinical experience?
100%.
I see that within the gay community, the eating disorder is really huge now.
Oh, really? Yeah. Why is that, do you think?
Because there has been, within the gay community, we also have a very clear, particular, I allow myself even to say, stereotypical picture of beauty to which eating disorder fits, the same as with women and girls.
Oh, okay. Oh, that's so sad.
Yeah. Absolutely, absolutely. There are three different types of eating disorder, right? We have anorexia, where we try to control the weight by not eating, by exercising too much, most of the time doing both. We have bulimia, where we lose control over how much we eat and we take really drastic action not to put on any weight. You know, this you could eat, for example, cotton wool to feel full but not to eat anything. And then we have BED, which is binge eating disorder, where people eat large proportions of food very, very quickly, and then they purge, so they make themselves sick. So it's different types, but of course, all of them have, at the end, the same nature, which is control. And I think that's something I would love to say about eating disorder, if you allow me, is that what we see in clinic is that in some level, eating disorder has always got something to do with having lost control over your wider life. And the point of control you are still having is the one around food intake. And this becomes quite obsessive. You see, I'm using the same word as OCD, within OCD. Of course, it's different, but there are some similarities. but the obsessiveness about controlling my own life through the intake of food is quite often something we see in the nature of eating disorder, regardless of the category.
Oh, well, thank you so much for that. That's really helpful to better understand these types of issues that people are going through. And I think it will be really beneficial for our listeners. So thank you so much for going through that. It's been wonderful.
Thank you so much for having me. And
thank you.
It helps.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.
If you have any comments on the podcast or you'd like to suggest a topical speaker or provide other feedback, you can contact us using the email editor@workplacewellbeing.pro. We look forward to hearing from you. Follow us on Twitter @WorkWellPro or join us on LinkedIn and Facebook. My second guest speaker today is Ruth Kudzi, who is a psychology and neuroscience expert and master coach who is passionate about sharing the science behind brain function. She is the author of the global best-selling book How to Feel Better and the founder of Optimus Coach Academy, an institution specializing in evidence-based coaching approaches. Ruth holds a master's degree in psychology and education and a BA in psychology and management. She's also trained in cognitive behavioral therapy, neuro-linguistic programming, and spiral energy. Hello, Ruth. Thank you so much for joining us today. How are you?
I'm really good, thank you.
Great, that's great. Okay, so as we move into the second half of our discussion, we're joined by an expert in the field of psychology and neuroscience, and that's Ruth. Ruth is here to offer a unique perspective on creating supportive work cultures for, as we've addressed, anxiety, depression, PTSD, OCD, and eating disorders. So let's just dive straight in today, Ruth, and into practical solutions for a common issue that many leaders face, and that is anxiety among employees. So what are some effective strategies that leaders can implement to support employees who may be experiencing anxiety, and how can workplace policies be adapted to better accommodate and assist these individuals?
So I think, you know, first of all, it's about really making sure that the culture means that people feel it's safe to speak up. So often people have a preconception that they're not able to share if they've got any kind of mental illness or they're suffering from anxiety. So the way that you can do that is obviously by modeling as a leader and with the team, and by providing spaces that are safe and non-judgmental. So actually giving the space to people to share what's going on for them and to really listen, and listen on a deep level. So anxiety is going to manifest differently with different people. And I think that sometimes one of the things that people can get wrong is they can feel like it's very personalized. So, you know, it might be that a member of your team is suffering from anxiety and you might be thinking, oh, what have I done? But actually just listen to them and give them that space to have a conversation, to think about, okay, what can we do to support? Because it may be that you're changing, you know, how they do some of the role. You might be changing how you communicate some things. You might be, you know, so you're making reasonable adjustments to support them. It might also be that you're offering additional support, you know, external to the organization, maybe if that's with counseling or therapy. So I think the really key thing here is about having the conversation with the person or people, but doing so in a way where you're non-judgmental. So you're really seeing that as a starting point with the goal that you're going to support them in a way that works for them. And that's going to be different for different people. And I think you can also look at how you can have more training, both, you know, the leaders and fellow employees in the organization, and more support in terms of making sure that you've got a service that you can refer people to. But in the starting point, it's about having that human to human interaction.
Open and honest conversation. So important. Yeah. Okay, thank you for that. That's really helpful. And given your expertise in psychology and coaching, this next question is particularly close to the heart of many, well, I hope many conscientious leaders, and it does relate to depression. So in instances where a leader might suspect that an employee is suffering from depression for whatever reason, could you share your insights on the most sensitive and constructive approaches they could take to offer support?
I think it's about creating a sensitive and empathetic space. So actually making sure that you're not jumping to conclusions. So again, when you're having a conversation, think about the things that you can highlight that are concrete. So maybe you're noticing that they were really engaged in things and maybe they've lost that level of engagement. So bring it back to things that you can observe. So you might say, I've noticed that you used to really speak up in meetings and be engaged, and I've noticed recently you're not so engaged. What's going on? So have something to mark it to rather than that general, because again, what you're wanting to do is open up the conversation, but not be confrontational or not make them feel worse. So you want to make sure that you've got that empathetic style and you're saying, what is going on and how can we support you? I think it's really useful not to think in your head, I'm not going to label or diagnose, because actually there could be lots and lots of different things going on. So that openness, asking them, what is going on? And you might want to be saying, just starting with a general conversation as well, very much like the anxiety. How is everything? How's it working? And bringing up those examples. But then, if they are disclosing that, yes, they're struggling, asking them about support, asking them about what they need, looking at what can be done inside work as well as outside work. And it is, all of this is really about creating that culture of dialogue, because it's so easy to think that we know without actually hearing what's going on for the person. So don't be afraid to have a conversation, but when you are, it's that avoiding jumping in with your ideas or what you think. It's much more about them.
Yeah, amazing. Thank you. And of course, it's something I've been hearing all the time is no one size fits all. And yeah. People are so unique and will have different ways of handling certain things. So very important. Thank you. So turning our attention to a less visible issue within our workspaces, and that is PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, certainly a topic that requires careful consideration and isn't talked about so much. But I was wondering if you're able to share what type of environment would best support those coping with PTSD, and any thoughtful steps and specific accommodations that leaders can implement to ensure these employees feel understood and valued.
So I think letting them know that they're valued and asking them about support and working with appropriate professionals is really, really good. I think as well, we can think about the culture. So with any kind of mental illness, we need to think about what we're modeling as an organization. So again, it's really easy to have a policy, but what are we putting in place? So, is the organization, is there a space where we have breaks, where we have flexible working, where we make it okay for people to take mental health days, where we provide support? How are we, where somebody can know that it's okay to say, I'm having a really bad day. They know who they can, they know that they can let you know that. And you also, it's about, if that happens, how do you make sure that their work is still being done? So it's about having systems. Sometimes it's about having those boring systems and processes behind everything, so that actually, if you do have an employee that's struggling with PTSD and maybe they're having flashbacks or they're going through a difficult time, they know that it's okay to say, I need to take, I'm not at my full capacity today. I need to take it easy, or can I take a break? And that you'll have them covered. Because often what can happen is we can say, oh yes, of course this can happen, and we're really open to all of this, but we don't have that in place. And so what will happen is the employee will take a step back and they'll come back to more, and that isn't going to help them in terms of their mental well-being. So definitely thinking about what the behaviors are, what the cultural norms are, and modeling that so people know that they can behave and ask for help if they need it.
Yeah, you've mentioned role modeling a couple of times now. This is obviously something that leaders really need to be considering when it comes to mental health in the workplace. What are some of the best ways to role model positive behaviour, do you think?
I think, first of all, a really, really simple thing to do is look at your workload as a leader. And if you've got a calendar that's visible to others, put in breaks, put in space, you know, leave early. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, say that you can't come to meetings because you've got other things on. Mm-hmm. Share if, you know, actually I'm having a bit of a bad day today. Can I come back to you that tomorrow? Make it okay not to be okay, but also demonstrate things that demonstrate well-being. You know, lots of people say, oh, well, you know, one of the things that we did actually as an organization is I started to put my lunch break in my calendar. And guess what? All of my team now have their lunch break in their calendar because having that space, they recognize that that's really important. And so it's something that we all do. You know, actually sharing in meetings, I've got a lot on this week, so I need that. You know, again, if we're starting that dialogue, it helps.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I remember speaking to Sarah Bartlett. She works with Disability Forum. And she said that her manager started going for walks over their lunch break. And instead of working through it, as a lot of managers would often do, actively going out for a walk for that hour and having your employees and teams see you going out there and taking that break and getting fresh air and seeing something different was massively beneficial towards the entire team. And it ended up that the whole teams were going out with him to walk around on their lunch break, which I think is just lovely.
It is. It's that whole thing. It's so easy to say, do this. But when people see you doing it as leaders, it gives them permission. Mm. You know, so when people see you talking about actually, maybe you're getting support for your mental health, you know, and obviously only if you are, it gives them permission as well. So it's all about that modeling as well as, you know, that open, honest culture where people do feel supported.
Lovely, thank you. And I just want to skip ahead quickly just to cover some eating disorders as our final point of today's session. And given the intricacy of these conditions, could you advise on the best practices for leaders when it comes to providing support for employees dealing with these struggles? And how might leaders cultivate a work environment that not only understands but actively promotes a culture of health and body positivity?
One of the things that I want to say that sometimes as managers, we can think that we need to fix everyone's problems, but that's not our job. Our job is to create a space where they can succeed at work. So that is about making adjustments. It's about our culture, but also it's about getting them the right support. And so that may be external to the workplace, but making sure it's signposted, allowing people to have time off, making sure they don't need to put that in their diaries if they've got time off. And this is for everything, but I think especially for eating disorders. Letting people know that if they share with you and, you know, with HR, it's confidential. Because I think that's a huge thing, because people can feel a lot of shame and stigma, but actually knowing, well, this is a safe space and a confidential space can really support people as well.
100%. Couldn't agree more. Well, thank you so much, Ruth. You shared some really wonderful insights there today. I think leaders will really get a lot from that and how to cultivate these positive workspaces. So thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
The Mind Body Work podcast is brought to you by workplacewellbeing.pro, a website dedicated to the well-being and health of working professionals.
Daily news items are posted, accompanied by in-depth analysis of topics including financial well-being, mental health, and stress. You can sign up for our weekly newsletters to keep up to date with our content. Thank you for listening.